Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your taxes and preparing your taxes. Scott Franklin joins us. This is the first time for Scott. He's a certified public accountant, also holds a law degree. He's a third-generation CPA, second-generation lawyer. He's a lifelong resident of Milwaukee, and he joined Kohler and Franklin, certified public accountants, in 1995. He concentrates on the firm's tax and estate planning and business advisory and litigation support practices. So he's also an experienced writer and teacher on both accounting and legal topics. And he joins us today from our Milwaukee studios. Always great to talk taxes and tax preparation. And it's great to have Scott Franklin with us. Scott, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Busy time of the year for you, I imagine.
It's starting to gear up and working on getting out W-2s and 1099s, all those forms that taxpayers get from their banks, brokers, employers that they need before they can actually do their income tax return.
Yeah, I know all about that. And we're seeing some of that come in the mail now. And there are deadlines. Isn't it like the end of the month, this month?
Yeah, typically what happens is the W-2s from your employers have to be issued by January 31st. In a perfect world, 1099s from banks and brokerage firms would also be issued by then. There are complicating factors with tax law changes, and over the last several years, it seems like the brokerage firms where they have more complicated 1099s don't get those out until mid to late February, because if they rush them out in January, they send out corrected forms and we wind up redoing tax returns anyways. So
I guess it's better to wait in that circumstance.
Exactly. And there's a big change this year to the 1099B, which is the form that is used to report stock transactions. If you buy stock, nothing used to be reported to the government. When you sold stock, the government knew you sold it, but they didn't know what your profit on it was. And as part of trying to not change the tax laws, but to encourage compliance with the existing rules, 1099Bs now will be reporting the basis of stocks sold for stock sales of stock that was purchased starting January 1, 2011. And this is phasing in over a three-year period of time where starting in 2011, brokerage firms have to report purchase prices to match up with the sale of stock that happens during the year. Next year, it expands to mutual fund reporting. And then, in theory, by 2013, whenever you sell a stock or a mutual fund or a bond, not only are they reporting the proceeds of the sale, they're going to report the cost that you had so that the IRS knows what your profit is on that stock or mutual fund.
Or loss.
And what's happening is it's going to take years and years for this to filter through because the brokers don't have to report transactions that happened before 2011. So if you're sitting on stock that you've had for 30 years and you sell it, the broker still doesn't have to report anything to the IRS, but if you bought something today and you sell it in a couple years, that profit or loss will now be reported to the government.
Okay, there you go. Well, tell you what, we already have some callers online to visit with you, and let me give that number again. If you'd like to join us, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post there. Scott Franklin, our guest, CPA with Kohler and Franklin CPAs, working out of Milwaukee. And Tom in Green Bay has a question for you, Scott. So let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wrote it down so I can try to make sense of it.
Okay.
I got paid a taxable insurance benefit in 2010. And I got a W-2 last year, of course, for that amount. And this year, when a second insurance started, it paid retroactively. And the agreement was that the first one would take back. I'd have to reimburse the first one for the period of time, so I wasn't double paid. So I'll get another W-2 this year. How will I reconcile that on my taxes?
So reconciling the fact that you're repaying benefits that were previously taxed?
Yes.
If this is reported on a W-2, there is a provision that allows you to take a deduction on a itemized deduction schedule, Schedule A, for a repayment of wages. I've only actually had to do the procedure myself a couple times, but it is possible to reconcile. I would suggest going into the IRS.gov website, which has a wealth of information, to find out the exact protocols. Essentially, what you're going to do is, at least in the situation I had several years ago, we had to rerun the tax return for the current year with and without the extra income, figure out what the differential was, and we took a deduction on the Schedule A. It is something that can be done. Unfortunately, just in the time constraints I have here, it's kind of difficult to walk through it, but it is possible to take a deduction for the repayment.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jane in Thiensville. Do you know? Hi, Jane. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I've been in a financial bind. I purchased a property, a small property, with a partner years ago, and the partner unfortunately became very mentally ill and has had to go and live with his family in California now. So the property values have fallen. I had to pick up a lot of slack when he lost his job. And now I don't have enough money. I paid part of my quarterly taxes this year, but I don't have enough money to pay my taxes this year. Next year, my income will double. I don't know what to do. This has never happened to me before.
So your income in 2012 is going to be double that of 2011, and what you're saying is you can't.
That's right.
You're at this point, you're not going to be able to pay your 2011 taxes.
That's right.
Okay, Scott, what do we do in that situation? I assume we need to get a hold of the IRS, but.
It's with the economy, I've seen that more frequently than in the past, where for various reasons clients are not able to fully prepay their estimated tax obligation or the balance due on the tax return coming up. The usual advice I give to our clients is worry first about 2011. And get your 2011 tax return completed as soon as possible. If it turns out that there is money that you're going to owe on the tax return, the first thing I would tell them is to try and pay the Wisconsin tax liability in full first. The Wisconsin taxes are deductible on your federal tax return. So it's kind of like a double benefit. You pay off the state of Wisconsin and you get a credit for that in most cases on your federal return. If it turns out that you are unable to pay your tax liability, then you can request an installment payment plan with the IRS or, for that matter, state of Wisconsin. For instance, the IRS will set up direct withdrawals from your bank account for a dollar amount that is mutually agreeable so that they allow you to pay the money off over time. They charge you approximately $100 to set up the installment plan, but by having a formal installment agreement with the IRS and Wisconsin, that eliminates the likelihood that they will garnish your bank account.
Yeah.
So going forward to 2012, certainly you want to try and pay the quarterly estimates based on what you think your liability will be. Keep in mind that quarterly taxes, the minimum, should be based approximately at 100% of this year's taxes. So even if your income is going to double for 2012, you don't necessarily have to pay all that upfront as quarterly estimates. But again, keep in mind you're going to have that liability in April of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but how, if I pay installments now, then how am I even going to pay my quarterly taxes for 2011?
Well, I guess I'm assuming you're not going to pay the quarterly amount for 2011, and so you would be using the installment plan on the balance due as shown on the tax return to pay it off. If you truly don't have the funds available, the IRS can work with you on a procedure called an offer and compromise, and that is to try and negotiate with the tax authorities to make your tax bill go away. Unfortunately, they want full disclosure of all your net worth, your assets, property, real estate, investment in stocks and bonds, that sort of thing. And if it looks like you have assets, they would require you to liquidate some of your net worth before they would make the tax liability disappear altogether.
So since your income is going to be doubling in 2012, it sounds to me like that other option of trying to get the monthly payment schedule. To me, Scott, that sounds like a better approach.
That's probably going to be the easiest approach to implement. It's straightforward, and it should at least keep them at bay so that the tax people don't get more aggressive in enforcement.
Okay, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck, Jane. Appreciate your call. We're turning to Bill in La Crosse next. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. My question is sort of two-part. Well, no, I guess not. I'm concerned about the alternative minimum tax, both for 2011 and 2012. Has there been a patch or anything to help that situation on either of those years?
Okay. And for those listeners who aren't familiar with what the AMT is, the income tax system has a mechanism where they decided several decades ago to come up with an alternative minimum tax, and they basically take away all sorts of tax deductions for property taxes, income tax payments, some medical expenses. They have a different tax rate schedule, and then they compare the alternative minimum tax to the regular tax, and you're essentially paying the higher of the two numbers. As it stands right now for 2011, the AMT thresholds are approximately the same as what they were in 2010. Congress did pass their annual adjustment late in 2009, effective for the 2010 tax return and 2011. Right now, absent legislative action, the AMT is going to get significantly worse for 2012. I have to assume that in this election year they're going to fix it so that that doesn't come up to be part of the political landscape talking about AMT problems.
Yeah.
But that is an increasing problem, especially in tax happy states like Wisconsin with a higher level of income taxes and property taxes than in some of the other states.
Okay, thank you. That's a terrible tax because it's hitting people that it wasn't intended to hit.
Yeah,
that's correct. I remember a statistic that said the original AMT was intended to catch 500 people.
Yeah.
And it wasn't properly indexed for inflation, so each year it gets more and more middle-income taxpayers, except for the fact that Congress does do a little tinkering on an annual basis.
Yeah, but they don't do anything right. They're so screwed up. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, I've even there's been talk that there's reluctance to have it changed because it of the amount of income it brings into the government.
And that's a big problem with any tax law change. They're looking at even if you give a $1,000 tax credit for educational expenses, well, the government's losing that $1,000 of revenue. How do they make it up?
Yeah. Scott Franklin, our guest today, is certified public accountant with the firm of Kohler and Franklin CPAs in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Michelle Good, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your tax preparation today with our guest, Scott Franklin, CPA, with Kohler and Franklin, CPAs out of Milwaukee. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. If you have a question about your taxes, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and you can post there. Linda in Madison is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Linda.
Hi. My son moved to Minnesota to take a new job and he couldn't sell his home prior to moving, so he's renting it to a friend. I didn't know how that figured, if he could still do the 1040E. Where do we report that and how?
If he is renting the house out, he's going to have to file a Schedule E as an elephant on the 1040, the main form tax return now. So he'll have to file the full-blown 1040 income tax return. If he is a Minnesota resident, he will be filing a tax return with the Minnesota authorities as a Minnesota part-year resident. He would file a Wisconsin tax return as a part-year Wisconsin resident. But since he's now living in Minnesota while renting property in Wisconsin, he actually has to file the two tax returns. Wisconsin will tax his income on the rental property, if any. Minnesota will also get part of it, and there's some tax credits in there. If he is renting this out and it's a bona fide rental situation, he'll be able to take deductions against the rental income for property taxes, depreciation, if he's paying for utilities or lawn mowing, anything like that. It's not.
Where would we report deductions against rental income?
That all goes on the Schedule E.
Okay, all right.
And Schedule E lists the most common types of rental expenses for advertising or cleaning, et cetera, and that gets all tallied up on that form, and then that works its way back to the front page of the Form 1040.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And someone else who had couldn't sell their house and living elsewhere in Wisconsin and wondering, what's going to happen when we go to fill our taxes out? And so Schedule E is the place to go.
Yes.
All right. Gary and Rhinelander, on to you. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Hey, I've got a question that I'm married now, and from years ago I had some issues with child support, and now they're arrears. And out of these arrears, it's like $54,000, and basically it's $18,000 and $36,000 worth of interest on that. Right now, since April of 2011, I've been working as a subcontractor, basically driving 60,000 miles a year. And I'm wondering, will the IRS take that in consideration of the job that I have, having to buy a car to keep going in my job and working, with maybe taking some money out for child support arrears?
Well, if you're asking, will the IRS take part of your tax refund and apply it to child support obligations, the answer is generally going to be yes. Wisconsin and most of the other states and the IRS all participate in a refund intercept program. So if you have child support obligations or unpaid parking tickets or any other kind of obligation that the government are aware of, there will be refund intercepts, which means if you have money coming back, they will send it to pay off the existing liabilities before they give you a cash refund. If you are an independent contractor and you have all sorts of various business expenses, that will lower your income tax liability depending on how much estimated tax you paid in. You may or may not have a refund that would be intercepted.
Okay.
All right.
So thank you very much.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And on to Gene in Portage. Hi, Gene. Thank you for calling.
Hello. How are you today?
Great.
So my question really, in July, my fiance moved from Connecticut to Wisconsin for work, and I came out in September with him, and in October we got married, and so we're going to have, you know, Connecticut taxes and Wisconsin, but we're probably going to file married filing jointly, but I'm just wondering what discounts and things we should be eligible for given that we were moving in for a new job and things like that.
Okay. Moving expenses will generally be deductible. What you would have the ability to deduct would be the moving van, moving the stuff out here, the one-way transportation of yourself by airfare or by driving your car, the cost of hotels and food on the ride in from Connecticut. And so there is a moving expense deduction, and it would go on the form 39. I'm just looking this up on the IRS website. It is the form 3903.
Okay, and I think I was looking at that the other night, and there were like three criteria you had to meet for it. And I think we meet the first two, but he's started work in July and hasn't been 38 weeks, I think. Either 38 or 39 weeks that it needed to be. And if it's not eligible this year, how do we claim it for next year or be able to get the discount that we should get because we were moving?
Right. The requirement to deduct moving expenses is based on being in your new job for 39 out of 52 weeks following the move. You are able to take that deduction in this year's tax return on the assumption that you have met the 39-week requirement. If it turns out that after you file your tax return, you do not meet the requirement, you can amend the tax, or you're required to amend the tax return and undo the deduction. But as long as you are expecting to meet the requirement, you are allowed to take the deduction.
Well, he won't meet that's the part of the requirement until April of this year. Right. So how do we claim it for next year's tax? So then we won't be.
Well, you just claim it this year.
Yeah, you would claim it on your 2011 tax return. The IRS isn't all nasty. It assumes that if you move for a job, you'll keep the job, even if it crosses into next year. And so as long as you don't lose the job, you are allowed to take that deduction on the 2011 return.
Okay, all right. So then we won't have to amend anything because he should still be there by April.
Yep.
Correct.
Okay. All right, that's perfect. I was just wondering how that works.
All right. There you go, Gene. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dawn in Madison emailed us, says, my son graduated from college in May, hasn't found a job. He's moved back in with us, now works a minimum wage job. Can we claim him on our taxes?
The issue would be how much income is he making? And if he's providing enough to meet the definitions of dependency exemptions, you would be able to take him as a deduction. If he was a full-time student at Madison for at least 5 months during the year, even though he graduated in May, If he, a typical Madison semester is January through May. So if he was a full-time student for the spring semester and he is under age 24 at the end of 2011, he should qualify as a dependency exemption, which would allow you to take the tax deduction on your return for him. If he is older than 24 or wasn't a full-time student, then we're looking at a slightly different test to take a dependency exemption deduction, and his income would have had to been below approximately $3,700 for the year.
There we go. Let's another email here. My daughter's studying abroad on a fellowship. Funds received are for cost of living and education. Any tax liability relating to this fellowship? Will she receive a 1099 or something similar?
If the fellowship is a scholarship type of arrangement, that would generally be tax-free. If this is compensation for services rendered, there really could be some tax consequences. There may be a 1099 issued by the issuing by the paying entity, and that would be a definitive thing. The IRS rules regarding scholarship money, it really depends on whether you're getting compensation for services rendered as a teaching assistant, or if this is purely a scholarship to allow somebody to study uninterrupted. The IRS has on their website a discussion of scholarship and fellowship grants, and it talks about some of the criteria, and there really needs to be an allocation of the money that was for room and board, travel, non-required equipment, so that you can allocate between what is not taxable versus what may be taxable.
Peggy in Burnett County, it is your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about remodeling houses and selling them. My partner and I do a lot of remodeling, and we enjoy it. And we thought about getting into this for a profit. If we did purchase a house and or say houses and remodeled them, resold them for a profit, would that income then be capital gain income, or is it ever taxed as self-employment income if you do enough of it? And also, if it is capital gain income, do you add the ordinary costs or expenses such as utilities, little things like that that you ordinarily wouldn't add to your basis? Do you add those or capitalize those costs to come up with your – to calculate your profit?
Sure. If you are buying one house at a time, I would feel comfortable saying that it is a capital gain item. If you were doing multiple properties at the same time, now it's starting to look a little bit more like you have an inventory of real estate, and the argument might be made that it's going to be more ordinary income versus capital gain. In any event, you would track all of your improvements to the property. You would obviously take your purchase price plus the cost of all the improvements and use that to determine what your basis is versus the selling price when you turn around and hopefully make a profit on it. Other expenses such as real estate taxes, mortgage interest, the deductibility of that may also depend on or will depend on whether it's going to be capital gain property or ordinary income property. It is also possible to, while you're sitting on a piece of capital gain property to deduct the property taxes as investment expense, depending on other issues with your tax return, real estate tax or I should say investment expenses may not be fully deductible. The interest expense, there may be a couple different ways to deduct it. And so if you were going to have multiple properties, this is probably a good area to sit down and chat face-to-face with a tax preparer before you go in with both feet, just to make sure you map out what it is you're doing, what your time frame is, and hopefully your expected profit, so that you can maximize the tax savings and minimize consequences.
Yeah, there you go. I had a friend who had a freelance business, and he was a single guy, and he bought an old beat-up house, and then when he didn't have freelance work, he worked on the house. He fixed the house up, and so he was always working. Either he did his freelance communication work, or he was working on his house. And then he'd sell the house when he got it all fixed up and go to the next one.
Hmm.
It was, and he did very well at that, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, a little harder to do it.
You're always living in squalor, kind of, you know, there's never. And he said about the time that you started to get the bathroom to remodel, that's when he would get really busy, and so he'd sit there without a bathroom until he could get it fixed. So there's downsides to it.
Yeah, and with this economy, anything you can do to sell a piece of real estate at a profit is real either luck or very good business planning, unfortunately, the way things are right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Peggy. Appreciate your call. Jane is emailing us and says, I'm an independent direct sales consultant on a very part-time basis, had more expenses than profits this year. I heard there's an easy form to use rather than the regular C form. Is this true?
There is a streamlined version of the Schedule C. It's called a Schedule C-EZ for easy. Essentially, you're still reporting you're essentially still reporting all your income, but as long as your business expenses are less than $2,500, you don't have to detail the expenses. You just deduct the number, and that's the end of it. But if your business expenses exceed $2,500, you're required to use the Schedule C, the full version, which isn't that much worse. It's one sheet of paper versus two.
Yeah, it's not all that bad. Steve wonders, in Madison, wonders, what are the basic criteria by which a married couple decide to file jointly or separately?
Generally, it's a decision that the spouses can make. The tax law says you are married if you're not unmarried as of December 31st of the year. So as long as you're married, you have your choice, married filing separate, married filing joint. Many tax rules have different phase-out limits or dollar limitations that for a joint tax return give you a better benefit than if it's a married filing separate tax return.
If there's a big difference in disparity in the incomes of the two, I think,
well,
does that make a difference? Somebody told me it did.
It depends. In Wisconsin, we have community property, marital property income tax rules, which means that if you're a husband and wife living in Wisconsin, generally speaking, you have to, on married filing separate returns, report one half of all the income on each person's tax return. So in Wisconsin, we're not really seeing a lot of people filing married filing separate returns if it's a happy marriage. In some of the divorce litigation I'm involved in, there are other considerations for filing separate returns. With the tax planning software that is available, we can do a pretty good job of estimating what the taxes are before or by filing joint or by filing married filing separate. And it usually winds up that a joint return, at least for Wisconsin married couples, is going to be the better route in terms of not paying as much money to the government.
We had Alex from Middleton wondered if there's any way to deduct an elderly parent from our taxes.
Yes. And again, it depends on if the parent meets the definition of a dependency exemption. And elderly parent is probably going to be more older than age 24. And so you have to really look at the other criteria. So if the child is providing the place for the elderly parent to live, not necessarily a mother-in-law's room in your house, but paying the nursing home bills or the apartment rent, if that elderly relative has minimal income below $3,700, if the child is providing more than half of that elderly person's support during the year, then it is possible to take a dependency exemption and deduct take a deduction for that parent. If you have multiple children that are all supporting an elderly parent and nobody is providing more than half the support, there's a form that's called a multiple support declaration that allows the kids to agree that mom will go on my tax return this year and your tax return next year, and you can mix and match. But the key is looking at how much it's costing to take care of mom or dad during the year and whether or not you're providing more than half of that money to do so.
There we go. Anor in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, thank you for calling. Oh, I'm sorry, Andre. Is Andre, are you there from Green Bay?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thanks for the show, Larry. It's a good topic. I was just wondering, I've lived in Wisconsin now since 2006, and every other year the state takes $600 out of my state return. One year I'll receive $1,200. The next year it'll say that I'm going to receive $1,200, but I only get a check for $600. And they've done that to me since I've lived in the state of Wisconsin. Now, I've never filed unemployment. I don't pay child support because my children live with me. And, I mean, I don't understand why they're taking $600 from me every other year.
Well, that sounds a little strange. Scott, you know?
The refund intercept program may be what's happening here, and there might be some tax debt that you do not know about that is causing Wisconsin to take money. There could be an error being made on the tax return for whatever reason, if it's on an every other year basis. Basically, I would suggest giving the Department of Revenue a phone call in Madison, and they would be able to explain to you what the problem is. Nowadays, they've got some better paperwork as well, and so they're supposed to be sending out explanatory letters when issuing a refund if the refund is not
not the same as what you figured it was
right.
going to be. Yeah.
The Department of Revenue's main customer service phone number in Madison for individuals is area code 608-266-2772.
Okay. 266-2772?
Yes.
And area 608. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for calling. David in South Milwaukee, we'll get to you in just a second. Just to remind everybody, our guest today, Scott Franklin, certified public accountant with the firm of Kohler & Franklin, CPAs in Milwaukee. Our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, CPA Scott Franklin, talking tax preparation. Now let's turn to David in South Milwaukee, who has a question. David, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Timely program, folks. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what the obligations of an IRA trustee were to process a Roth conversion in the year that it was received. Scenario was that my brokerage went bankrupt last year and client money was missing, and I didn't find out how much I was going to recover until the end of the year, so I didn't know what my losses were. Once I did, then I want to do a Roth conversion. I sent it in, faxed it on the 22nd of December. But they're telling me they cannot, they could not process it because it wasn't received by the 1st of December. And they do it on a first-come, first-served basis, and they can't backdate it. So I'm wondering if that is true or where I would what kind of regulating agency I would talk to in order to clarify that.
I am not familiar with any of the major rules governing IRA regulations and oversight. I do know that a lot of brokerage firms with year-end planning do set deadlines that they impose, and they say if you need something done by the end of the year, here's a deadline. If you miss the deadline, we'll do it on a first-come, first-serve-as-available basis. That being said, December 1st seems a little bit early to me to get paperwork in. I would suggest contacting, if the brokerage firm is still in existence.
Sounds like they're broke out of existence, though.
But is the money still at that firm, or is it at a different firm?
Transferred to another firm. It's the trustee who was saying they can't process it and they can't backdate it. It's out of the brokerage firm. The brokerage firm is not dictating it. It's the trustee.
Yeah.
I don't really have a good answer. I guess I would suggest contacting your current brokerage firm and finding out if they have any guidance. Most of the major brokerage firms have very good retirement plan departments, and they know all of the nuances of what is and isn't allowed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for calling. And we have a couple emailed us as 70 and 80 years old, own their own home, live simply, have about $1 million in retirement savings. Our only child is interested in purchasing income property near us. We'd like to loan her or gift her a substantial interest-free down payment. Any advice from a tax perspective?
The current gift tax rules would allow $1 million to easily be gifted, which is would be the complete net worth here. So if the parents wanted this couple wanted to make a gift of a substantial amount of money, they can just write a check and give it away. The gift tax rules basically say if you give up to $13,000 per person making the gift to any one beneficiary, you don't even have to report it. There's no consequence. So husband and wife could write a check for $26,000 and give it to anyone they want. There is a documentation requirement that says they would have to file a gift tax return by next April, but they would not have any tax consequences of income to the recipient. It would not be tax deductible to the person making the gift. It's just a wash. If they were to make a loan, it gets a little trickier because you have to figure out if there's going to be interest paid back on the loan. If they want to do this just as a gift, I would suggest writing a check for whatever they feel is appropriate.
Okay. Well, if it's more than $26,000, there's some tax implications.
There's some tax implications. Paperwork needs to be filed under current tax law. However, there would not be any money owed to the government. The estate and gift tax regime is kind of in a state of flux. And again, with the election year cycle, I think there's going to have to be some changes in the next couple of years. But right now, there wouldn't be any money to the government.
Let's go to Dennis in Oshkosh next. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for calling.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
I was just got a disability declaration from Social Security, and I only worked part of the year because then I got sick. And I'm just wondering on both the state and federal forms this year what I should be looking for deductions. And since I presume my only income is going to be disability, what should I be looking for in future years?
Well, for the period of time you were employed at the beginning of the year before you became disabled, that income will also be taxable in 2011. The Social Security disability, I'm assuming, is going to be tax-free. It's not going to be reported on a Social Security 1099 like normal Social Security benefits are. So if it's completely tax-free and that's your only income, there's really not a lot of deductions that you're going to have to take, because if you have no taxable income, you won't have any –
you don't even
need
have to
any
file.
Deductions. On the Wisconsin tax return, depending on the amount of disability income, Wisconsin does have a homestead tax credit where you can get some money back from the state of Wisconsin based on how much rent you paid or how much property tax you paid on your residence. And the eligibility for that does look at how much you had in taxable or tax-exempt income. So if your income is really tax-free, I would say you're not going to have to worry about deductions. If it turns out that the Social Security benefits are reported along on the same form as retirement benefits, again, depending on your total income level, Social Security may still not be taxable. And then, again, you would just worry about eligibility for the Wisconsin homestead credit.
There you go. Thank you for calling, Dennis. And Jane in Madison, let's turn to you. Hi, Jane. Jane, are you there?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. All right. My daughter graduated last May from college, but she did a full-time January term, and then she did an online class to get the credits. It was within 4 years. We paid for it. Do we get eligible then for one of those special college credits for her, even though she technically didn't go full-time for the spring semester? But she did go full-time in January and, as I said, an online class.
Well, if she qualifies as your dependent on the tax return,
she ended up getting the job, so she's now working.
So if she is not going to be on your tax return as a dependent, the tax credits for tuition will flow through to her tax return, unfortunately, even though you paid the check.
But she can then get a special benefit for that herself, so that's okay then, I guess.
Yeah, if she is a college if we're talking about tuition expenses essentially for her senior year of school, she should be eligible for the lifetime learning credit. It's possible she also or could alternatively qualify for the American Opportunity Credit. Both of these allow a deduction – I'm sorry, a tax credit, which reduces income tax liability in the range of $1,000 to $2,000,
right,
depending
right.
on expenses and the taxable income on the tax return.
Mm-hmm. But could she still be a dependent on ours if she – what's the limit on how much she had to make last year?
Well, if she was a full-time student for more than – for parts of 5 months.
It would have only been the January that she was full-time, and then she was working there.
So she wouldn't qualify at all for us. Correct. Right? If her income for the year is more than $3,700, she needs to file her own return and take her own personal exemption.
Okay, so she could get that credit. Okay, well, that's good. I'll let her know then.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jane. Appreciate your call very much. We have Teresa in Green Bay up next. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I also have a college student, and I am told that he cannot fill out the FAFSA form as an independent person because he's 19 years old, even though he's going to school. He's going to school full-time, but he's also working full-time on all of his breaks, which covers his rent, and he's getting his own loans, which covers his tuition. And he cannot, am I understanding this correctly, he cannot fill out those forms as an independent person. He has to be dependent under us, which means we can take all of his tuition expenses on our taxes.
Are you talking about the FAFSA? Or the income tax form?
The FAFSA form. He filled out FAFSA, and he has to be, for some reason, a dependent.
Hmm. You know, we're going to ponder this, and we'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And hang in there, Teresa, and I know Scott's going to be thinking about it. We'll be back after this quick look at the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at your taxes and tax preparation with Scott Franklin, certified public accountant, who is a lifelong resident of Milwaukee, and he is a member of the CPA accounting firm of Kohler and Franklin. Been there since 1995 in that firm. And so it's great to have him along. Thank you for listening in. If you have a question about your taxes, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Finally, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. And we have Teresa was on board with us, Scott, with questions about her dependent student.
Right, and I believe the question is getting more at how to fill out the FAFSA student aid form than the income tax return.
Right.
The FAFSA form does require parental information unless one of about 12 criteria is met. So for a typical 19-year-old college freshman, I'm looking at the form right now, it would be difficult to not have to fill it in, not provide the parental information on the FAFSA form.
Okay. So you pretty much have to do it.
Yes.
Well, okay. Then is he considered a dependent on my taxes and I can take all of the tuition credit benefit on our taxes?
You probably will. It would depend on how much income he's making during the year.
$4,900
for the year. I'm assuming you're still providing more than half his support.
We are not.
You're not.
If you're not providing any support for him, he's probably going to be able to take his own exemption on the tax return, and so the cost of his education would be deductible on his tax return, not yours.
There you go.
Then why can't he fill out the FAFSA form as an independent?
That's a good question.
It's a separate set of rules, separate set of requirements.
Yeah, whole separate deal there, Teresa, unfortunately. Thanks very much for calling. Walt in Washington County, on to you now. Hi, Walt.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you for having a very expert, knowledgeable, professional guest.
Thank you. What can we do for you today?
I need a clarification of the question about gifting. I know that we can gift $13,000 per gifter to our children. However, you then expanded that to saying we could gift more than that under certain circumstances or with a certain form or with a perhaps a renewable note, and we wish to gift, or at least we have contributed significantly more than $26,000 this year to our son, who's in a special circumstance. And we would like to gift it if we could, but we don't want our contribution to him at this time to be taxable.
Okay.
Okay. Essentially, the gift tax rules say that, again, you can give $13,000 per person, no questions asked, no paperwork, no tax liability. If somebody makes a gift of, let's just say, $100,000 to...
You're real close.
Okay.
To anyone, that $100,000 gift gets reported to the government. The first $13,000 doesn't count. The next $87,000 reduces your lifetime gift limit, which is currently around $1 million. And so you wouldn't owe any tax money on that. However, you are still... reporting it to the government. So unless there's a real big seven-figure total gift during your entire life, most people will not wind up paying any kind of a gift tax. In a situation where you seem to have a child with special needs, perhaps, there are various mechanisms that a estate planning attorney is able to draft to come up with the best way to set aside money for somebody who may need it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if we report the gift over the limit of $13,000 or $26,000 in our case, is that a tax consequence to the recipient?
No.
Or not?
No. No.
We just have to report it on a special form to the government.
Correct. And the form is 709.
709. Thank you. This
yes.
is very, very helpful.
All right. Thanks, Walt. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. All right. I'll tell you what, Scott, you made somebody happy there. Made Walt happy, for sure.
Very good.
Paul in Sturgeon Bay. On to you. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, guys. Great program. Thank you for your help.
Sure.
I got divorced August of last year. And my ex-wife and I have two children in college. And as standard divorce practice, we have to divide up all our income and deductions up to from the first of the year to the divorce. I'm wondering how we do that with the college fees. Obviously, we can divide the fees up, but then how do we assign the tax credit for those deductions?
Sure, and it gets a little sticky because the divorce decree, because the kids are in college, probably was silent on which parent was able to take the dependency exemption for the college-age kids. In my office, I do see this quite a bit. The first step is going to be to figure out which parent is eligible to take the dependency exemption for the child. If there was an agreement as part of the divorce process, abide by that. If there was no prior agreement, you have to go through the rules and figure out where the child was living during the time not away at school, who was providing the money to take care of the tuition expenses. And so you first have to decide who gets the exemption for the child. That being said, if mom and dad are both providing half the money for the child, again, under the rules, the tuition payment follows the dependency exemption. So even if mom is paying for half of it, you might be able to take that all into account on your tax return for the credit. Again, with the limits, it may not really matter much just in terms of what, depending on how much the tuition is, you might max out just based on the amount of money you paid yourself. But it is a process of first figuring out where the dependency exemption goes, and then figuring out, especially for the period of time after the divorce, who paid how much money. For the period of time before the divorce, I would split everything 50-50 between you and your ex-wife.
Okay.
Okay, I understand. Excellent. But so if you took the fees and divide them in half, if she put half on her return, obviously she'd get the tax credit for that. And I get, so I get the same tax credit for mine if both of them exceeded them.
The tax credit would only flow through if there's a dependency exemption. So if it if you're each able to claim one child, then you would each get the benefit of the tax credit for that child on the tax return.
Okay, and where would I, what document would I go to find the dependency regulations?
The dependency exemption rules are going to be very nicely spelled out in the on the IRS website, and it would be publication number 501.
Excellent. All Thank you, guys. I appreciate all your help.
All right. Thanks, Paul, for calling. Appreciate it. We have John in West Allis with a question for you, Scott. So let's go there. Hi, John.
Okay. Hi. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
I have a question regarding what is considered my gross income. I'm self-employed. Unfortunately, with the economy, my income is extremely low. I'm a handyman, and I've run into this situation with, like, Badger Care and food stamps, and I may be running into it with a child support issue. People are looking at my gross income as the total amount of money I've taken in. And if say, I put in a window for you, and I charge you $200 to do it, but the window cost me $100, I made $100 that day. But they're looking at my gross income as $200 and just going by that and not taking into account, you know, my materials and stuff like that. Do you have any advice on how I can get them to understand that, you know, $200 is not my gross income? My actual gross income was $100. Or, you know, do you have any advice on that?
Sure. Well, as you work your income tax return, your adjusted gross income and your gross income will be net of the expenses. So if you did charge $200,000 but you have $150,000 of materials, for tax purposes, your gross income will be the $50,000 figure as a self-employed person. The only advice would be to discuss it with whoever is analyzing it and try and explain to them what the issue is. I do know that for the Wisconsin high-risk insurance program, they look at Wisconsin income and have some add-backs, but they still would allow for the normal business expenses shown on Schedule C.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. We have another listener who emailed and said, I was under the impression that the homestead tax credit and the earned income tax credit had or will be expiring with the new budget in Wisconsin. Can you clarify this?
I am not aware that they are expiring for Wisconsin. The earned income credit, I believe, was tweaked on the Wisconsin tax return so that the calculation of it is a little simpler and based on the Wisconsin, based on the federal earned income credit. As far as the homestead credit, I am not aware that that is in jeopardy. I know for a fact it's available for 2011. I do not have any information that it's on the high risk of
chopping block
being eliminated. Yeah.
Okay. Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I just had a quick question about my wife's student loans. She went to school before we got married, and now she's got $16,000 in student loans from the government. Every year they take her taxes, which is fine because now she's not working. But the only thing I'm concerned about is, are they going to be able to intercept my taxes for her student loans?
If it's a joint income tax return that you file,
if you file individually, just so that way I don't get the shaft because of her student loans.
Okay, but you're okay. When you say individually, a married filing separate return. So a married filing separate return would should be okay because the refund is your property, yeah. not her property. So it should insulate it. I don't believe that they would try and intercept it. Again, saying Wisconsin has marital property, half okay. of that refund belongs.
I tried to work with them, and they're more than unwilling to work with me. I mean, I've tried to set up a payment plan, and they will not work with you. It's incredible. He said, unless you get $600 payment, first down payment, he's like, we're not going to do anything with you. I'm like, well, I'll send you $100 a month. Nope, it's got to be $600 first, and then we can start the payment.
That just
made me mad, so now I'm even more stubborn. I'm not going to pay it now because he just ticked me off.
Right, and unfortunately, that is an issue with the student loan company. If they have certified the tax, the debt to the tax authorities are generally bound on the repayment process.
Okay. Well, thank you for your answer. That's usually a hot topic. So.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. And a listener emailed wondering, can a state of Wisconsin multi-member LLC be set up for business and tax reporting wherein one of the members' names is non-disclosed on the state filing or maybe with an alias on the filing when setting up the LLC?
When establishing an LLC, it's a pretty simple process. It's done on the on a state website, and the only name that goes on the LLC registration is the name of the entity itself and the name of the organizer that's going to get annual mailings from the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. The LLC is going to have to file LLC tax returns, and those tax returns will have to have the names and ID numbers and address information for all of the owners. No alias would be permitted.
Donald in Burnett, we turn to you now. Hi, Donald.
Hi there. I've got a question here. Just got another one of those watch out emails, you know, about the 3.8% tax on sale of a home taking effect this year or next, and how, you know, is how true is that, or what does it really mean, and don't we pay tax anyway when we sell a home? Can you tell me anything about that?
I guess my question is, this is something I've not heard of, is this a tax that Wisconsin is going to levy, the IRS is supposedly coming up with?
It's a federal thing, to my understanding. The way it's presented is that it is going to be to pay for Obamacare, and you know, in order to pay for it, this is one of the things that's in the health care bill, you know, hidden way down in there, that whenever you sell a house, there's going to be 3.8% tax on that sale in addition to your realtor's fees.
I am not aware of anything like that. Under the current law, as it currently is and has been for the last decade, the sale of a personal residence, as long as you've lived in it for two of the last 5 years, is going to be completely tax-free, even if you is tax-free up to $250,000 of profit for a single owner, or $500,000 of profit for a married couple. So generally speaking, unless your house had tremendous appreciation, you're not going to have to pay an income tax on the sale of the house, either state or federal. I have not really read the Obamacare legislation terribly in depth, but I have not heard that they are coming up with a sale on real estate, a tax on real estate.
I guess that brings up another question, I guess, or a verification. And you said that any tax that is paid is on profit anyway. I mean, as is right now, it's after $250,000 of profit, not just the actual sale of the house. Yeah, right? Correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I'll have to review those emails again.
Yeah, well, you know how You know how the internet can be sometimes.
Yeah. Watch out. Here it comes.
Thanks a lot for calling. Gary in Cottage Grove, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
My question is income in a roommate situation tax reportable? My bank will not use it as far as income.
So you have a roommate in your home who's paying you some rent.
Right.
And you're wondering, do you have to report that as income?
Yes.
If this was a if you're renting out a spare bedroom in your house, you really should be reporting that as rental income on your tax return. You would, in all likelihood, offset that by an allocated share of expenses, property taxes, mortgage interest, whatever. So my initial reaction is, yes, this would be considered taxable income. If a lender is going to ignore it, that's a different issue between the lending company and how you fill out the application. But for income tax purposes, that should be picked up on the tax return.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Gary. Joan in Park Falls, hi to you.
Hi. 18 years ago, or 19 now, we started buying savings bonds every month for our daughter, who is now in college. They are in her name with my name as co-owner beneficiary. So, of course, college time, she cashed in some of them that were mature, and now we got a nice little statement that she has to claim X amount of interest on these bonds. Is there a way, I mean, she's not going to come close to what she's making. I think she's going to make like $2,000 this year in income. So is it beneficiary more beneficial for her to cash them in her name or for me to cash them in my name and claim them as education costs?
Well, this gets to be a little tricky. First off, the absolutely good news is U.S. savings bonds are never subject to Wisconsin tax, so it's just a federal tax issue.
Okay.
If the savings bonds would have been purchased in your name when you were age 24 or older and then held and cashed for educational expenses for your daughter, you would have been able to exclude that income from taxation as long as you used it for qualified college expenses. The fact that her name is on these bonds and you are listed as a co-owner, without doing a little more digging, I would believe that it makes it subject to taxation. And so if it is being reported with her name and Social Security number as the primary Social Security number, that income is going to go on her tax return.
Okay.
Depending on how much money she has on her return, she may or may not have a tax liability. If she is taken as a dependent on your tax return, the college expenses are going to go on your return, not her return. So you're able to take the benefit of the deduction for the expenses that were paid with this money. Unfortunately, I believe she's going to have to pay tax on that money.
And if she doesn't meet the minimum for income?
If her income is low enough, there's going to be a minimal tax consequence. But it would vary depending on how much taxable income she received on those savings bonds. And this is not the first time I've heard this situation where bonds are being bought incorrectly in the name of a child or were received as a gift in the name of the child. And for educational expenses, they really need to be in the parent's name.
There we go. And on that note, we have to close. Scott, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it. Look forward to another visit from you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Scott Franklin, a certified public accountant with the firm of Kohler & Franklin in Milwaukee. And we have a link to their Facebook page on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.